Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 89, recorded January 30th, 2013. Roger McGuinn. It's time for Triangulation, my favorite show of the week. I shouldn't say that. They're all my favorites, but I love doing this one in particular because I can really sit down and talk with an interesting person, somebody who's doing something interesting. And it's just, it's a nice conversation. I just love doing it, and I'm going to really enjoy today because one of my heroes, one of my favorite people in the world, is on with us, Mr. Roger McGuinn. It's good to see you, Roger. Are you in your home in Florida?
Yes, I am home in Orlando, Florida, and it's been really beautiful here today. It's been, I think, in the 80s.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Delicious weather.
Roger, everybody knows, of course, the founding member of the Byrds, the folk rock trio that wrote so many great songs, some of which recorded later by Bob Dylan, and he's been a geek for some years. Last time we talked, you made a solar refrigerator, I think.
Yep. Well, we went totally solar after that. We got solar panels on the roof, and now the solar refrigerator is a Sub-Zero. So
that's nice. But you learn a little bit about how a refrigerator, which cools things, could be made to work with the sun, which heats things.
Work with the sun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got into solar panels on a big scale, and then I finally got so many of them. They were on the driveway, and I told Camilla, my wife, I'd love to get it up on the roof. And she said, well, if you're going to put it on the roof, let's just do it right. So we got a contractor, and we did the whole roof with solar panels.
Are you fully off the grid?
It runs pretty much everything.
Are you completely off the grid?
Not completely. We grid tied because we sell back to them, but our electric bill is basically zero. We pay for a surge protector and administrative charges, and that's it.
How fun. Yeah. So Roger's also an inventor. He's holding the guitar that he invented, which is a seven string.
Right. It's got an extra string. Let's see if you look at the headstock. You can see there are four tuning pegs down on the bottom and three on the top. And the extra string's right in the middle. And the idea behind it is I wanted to get the best sound, the sound of a 12-string. The thing that I like about the 12-string the most is this pair of strings here, which goes like this. You might recognize that riff from George Harrison.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then it's also
like a drone.
High.
Is it like a drone string?
Well, it's an octave. You could call it a drone because the two strings are vibrating kind of in unison, but
right.
they're an octave apart. So it is a droning effect, yeah. So it gives that kind of bagpipe-y sound.
Right.
Well, that was always my favorite part of the 12-string. We did this riff with the 12-string. And I didn't want to fly with a 12-string. I got one of my nice 12-strings broken on the Concorde, of all things.
Oh.
They said they would treat our luggage with kid gloves. I said, yeah, the kid gloves, they put it on the forklift that they ran through the guitar case. They broke my 12-string.
Oh.
So I went to Martin. I said, could you make me a 6-string guitar that had the sound of a 12-string? And my idea is to put this extra string in the middle. And they made me one in the custom shop. And it was sitting around in Dick Boak's office. He's the customer service guy, the artist relations guy at Martin. And a couple of other guitar players came in and tried it out and said, hey, I love this. I want to get one too. So he made a whole run of them, and it's got my name on it. It's like, I think they made a couple of hundred of them altogether.
It has a beautiful sound. And, of course, you made the 12-string famous with the Byrds. That was a unique sound. I just read Keith Richards' biography, Life. And have you read it?
I have not.
I
heard that he snorted his father. That's all I know about.
Among other things. I think he snorted everything. But one of the things he talks about is the search for a sound that, you know, he talks about satisfaction and how he was looking for it. And he said
that came to him in a dream, I think, huh?
Yeah, and then he had an old reel-to-reel recorder, and he recorded over and over and over again to get the fuzz tone. And he said it was really, it did. He said it came to him in a dream, that famous riff.
Right.
How important is that to you? It doesn't seem like the Birds or any of your music is about a guitar riff or a hook.
Well, the intro to Mr. Tambourine Man was based on...
That's Bach.
Yeah, we were playing around with a little Bach.
Yeah.
I learned that from Pete Seeger's Goofing Off Suite back in the 50s. And I learned it on the banjo, and then I transferred it over to the guitar. And you can hear the similarity in the opening line of Mr. Tambourine Man. It's got a little bit of that sound to it.
I never knew that.
It's a Bach-inspired lick. So we were thinking hooks.
You were.
And the Beatles were the first ones to use the electric Rickenbacker 12-string because Rickenbacker gave them one back in 64. And George Harrison really took to it and used it in the movie A Hard Day's Night. Mm-hmm. And the Birds all went to see the movie A Hard Day's Night and came back. We took notes on what the Beatles were playing. Okay, Ringo's got Ludwig drums and George has a Gretsch guitar. Oh, he's got a Rickenbacker guitar. What's that? And then, oh, wow, it's an electric 12-string. I got to get one of those. So I traded in my acoustic 12-string and my 5-string banjo and got this Rickenbacker, which you can see up there on the wall. That's
beautiful. That's the original?
No, that's a signature model. It came out in the 80s, but it's the same model.
That's so neat. It's
a 370-12. Mine was a 360 when I got it.
Well, Web4457 in our chat room is chastising me, saying, what are you talking about? The Birds had some of the most memorable hooks in all of music.
All right.
I stand
corrected.
So you
read the chat board while you're doing this.
I don't have it on. Well, one of the reasons we call this Triangulation, the show originally was Tom Merritt and me interviewing a third person. But when Tom moved on, we said, well, how can we still call it Triangulation? I said, well, wait a minute, we've got the chat room. They're watching live, and they ask questions all the time. They're huge fans. So if from time to time, if you don't mind, I'll feed you a question or two from the chat room there.
I see it now.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I might want to clarify something, that Bob Dylan really didn't do our songs. We did his songs.
Vice versa.
Mr. Tambourine Man was Bob Dylan's song. And we were the first electric band to do a Bob Dylan song.
That's right. Before that,
it was pretty much Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Folkies were playing Bob Dylan. But we were the first to electrify it.
Completely turned around. I apologize for that.
That's okay. I just thought the Shat guys would get you.
Yeah, they would. I'm surprised they didn't yell at me.
Okay.
When did you become a geek, a gadget hound? Because I remember John C. Dvorak telling me that you were a gadget hound 20 years ago.
20 years ago, yeah. I met John about 20 years ago. But I've been into gadgets ever since I was 3 years old. My grandfather was an engineer who helped build some of the bridges in Chicago. And when I lived in Chicago as a young kid, he would take me down to their Museum of Science and Industry every weekend. And that's where I got into gizmos, you know, pushed buttons and made things work. One of my favorite ones was, it was an exhibit by Bell Telephone of a mobile telephone. This is back in the 40s when nobody had, you know, the cell phone wasn't thought of. Mobile telephones were big clunky things you put in the trunk and they ran on tubes. But it was a great little exhibit. It had sort of an electric train set, but there are no trains on it. There are little lights and everything. And the scenario was, somebody called the doctor and said, oh, no, Susie swallowed some poison. And the nurse says, oh, the doctor's in his car right now. I'll see if I can get him on his mobile telephone.
Ooh.
And so you see these little lights radiating out from the tower, and it goes to the car, and the doctor answers it and saves Susie's life. I went, wow, I got to get one of those.
Took a few years before you did, I think.
Yeah, it took about 40 years. I did have one of the first ones. So I had a briefcase phone back in 1972. It was made by Canyon Communications in the San Fernando Valley. And it was all transistors. It ran on the IMTS mobile system, VHS radio. And it was 25 watts. And I used to take it on airplanes, and I'd ask the flight attendant to ask the captain if I could make a phone call. And they'd usually say, okay. Now,
really?
This is like a cell phone is like half a watt.
Less.
This is like 50 times more powerful than a cell phone.
Incredible.
And I was using it back in the 60s in the 70s on airplanes. And the guy he let me do it, and it didn't do any harm.
Not one would crash.
No, not so far.
Wow. And you, who do you call with that? You just call people, say, you know where I am? You know what I'm talking to?
Yeah. Well, let's see. I would call my friends, you know, and you'd have to be kind of careful with it. You'd wait till you see the lights of a city coming up, and then you'd have about a three-minute window of opportunity so you could get the mobile operator and tell her your number and tell her the number you want to call, and she'd connect you. And you'd just say, yeah, hey, guess where I am, right? I'm flying over Chicago or Cincinnati or whatever.
How's Susie? Has she eaten any poison lately?
Susie's fine. She lived.
Did your dad want you to be an engineer, do you think?
No, my dad probably wanted me to be a football player.
A Chicago Bear?
Well, he didn't care. He was a football player for Loyola or something.
Neat.
So he loved football and boxing, and he tried to, you know, bring me up with that. But I didn't want to mess my fingers up because I had other use for them. So I didn't really go. I went on the track team instead. I didn't really go for football.
You can't really hurt your fingers running.
It's one time I jammed my finger in basketball, and I said, wait a minute, these ball sports are dangerous. I better save my fingers. So
you were a guitar player early on.
Yeah, I started when I was 13.
Yeah. See, that's good, because I think, you know, sometimes kids start at that age and they say, oh, it's too late already. And that's not too late.
Well, it wasn't in my case. No, I think it probably helps to start when you're 4 or 5 if you can do it. But
you don't have the reach. You don't have the dexterity. I mean, you have to get to a certain age before you can really do anything, right?
That's true. You do have to have your fingers grown up enough so you can. Well, they do have smaller guitars for kids, but then you have to transition from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, 13's it's young enough. Worked.
Were you listening to Pete Seeger at the time, or what was the music that you would listen to?
The first thing I heard, I had a transistor radio back in 1955, 56.
That was early, and, too.
Yeah, it was a Regency TR-1. Which was the first transistor radio ever made.
Wow.
People don't realize that transistor radios were like a big deal back then.
Oh,
it was
like the
iPhone of its day. And it was really amazing because it gave you independence. You could listen to rock and roll, which parents usually didn't like. And you had an earphone. I used to ride my bicycle around Chicago and tune into WJJD, which was a rock station at the time. And the first thing I heard, well, since my baby left me, well, I found any place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of the lonely street, a heartbreak hotel. Well, I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely. I'll be so lonely, I could die. And that got me hooked on music. That made me want to get a guitar.
What was it about that got you?
I can't tell you. I think it was something I'd never heard before. It was a synthesis of blues and country and things. And I hadn't seen Elvis. I just heard it on the radio. So it wasn't anything visual.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the first time I really wanted to play music as opposed to listen to it and dance to it.
Did you try to figure out how Elvis was, figure the song out?
Well, I wasn't good enough at the point. When I got my first guitar, I couldn't play it because the strings, the strings were about this high over
the fingerboard. Yeah, I had that guitar too. It hurt like hell.
It did. You couldn't play anything on it, really. Except I learned how to play one little lick. It's like...
Wait a minute. That was the first lick you learned, and you remember that?
Yeah. Well,
wow.
The reason I remember it is it was from the flip side of Bebopalula, and I loved Bebopalula.
Yeah,
and when I met George Harrison, he and I compared notes about the first thing we both learned on the guitar, and the first thing he ever learned was... So it was pretty cool.
That's really cool. That's really neat. I have a picture here. I don't know if, John, if you can see it, of the Regency TR-1. The first transistor radio. Wow. I think I have one of those lying around somewhere, actually. I think somebody gave me one of those. I'm pretty sure it's over in the radio corner. Did you become a ham? I can't remember. Are you? Uh-oh. Is he frozen? We lost him. We'll get him back in a second. Skype has failed us just as the music was starting to flow. They go for $300 and up now as collector's items, according to Web3511 in the chat room. I'm pretty sure we have one. You know what? I'm going to go look. Can you... Do you remember that transistor radio that was over on the radio?
Yeah.
I think that's a TR-1. Is it still there? Should be there somewhere. Huh? Maybe it's a Magnavox. It's a little transistor, right, in a box? It's little.
Yeah, it's not.
It's not a TR-1.
But it's old. This?
That's
also this one.
This is the one I was thinking of, the Zephyr. Look at that. And here's an old Magnavox. Oh, look at that. This is cool. I didn't even know we had this. That is really cool. That is some history. I have to show Roger.
Okay, are we back?
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, that's not your fault. It was my MacBook Pro dumped the router for some reason.
Oh, these things happen.
Yeah,
look what look what I just found. And this is an old Magnavox transistor radio.
And the earphone.
And the little earphone that you would stick in your ear.
That's the original, too, right?
Oh, yeah, you bet. In box original.
You know, they used to make them out of hearing aids, I think, back then.
It's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And, of course, the music was mono, so you didn't need more than one.
No, just one is good, yeah.
And I can remember
Even the bird stuff was mono to start with, because our producer, Terry Melcher, who is Doris Day's son, he thought stereo was a silly gimmick that he wasn't going to. He wasn't going to play with it. And he mixed for mono AM radio, you know, because car radios just had one speaker.
Right.
And that was how you got a hit, if you got people to play it in the car.
But so, I got to tell you, you know, when the Beatles came out with their box set a year or two ago, they came out with a stereo version and a mono version.
Yeah.
And a lot of people got the mono version because they wanted the original.
Right. Well, George Martin was a genius at mixing. Those mono mixes were incredible. And they were just using a four track back then.
Yeah.
So it was amazing.
When you first, do you remember the first time you went into a recording studio?
It was 1960. It was with the Limelighters. I was on an album called Tonight in Person.
Was it exciting?
Yeah, it's real exciting. It was great. Most of it was live, but we went into the studio to kind of sweeten it up a little bit.
I see.
So that was my first professional recording session.
So they'd already had the tracks from a concert.
Right. They had a truck out there to get the concert, and then they brought that to the studio and sweetened it up with a couple of overdubs.
Yeah. Did you, now, as a gadget hound, were you interested in the recording technology as you saw it?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I was really interested in television. My dad produced commercials for WBKB in Chicago, and he used to take me down to the studio and let me hang out there. And Richie Victor was the director, and I used to love this guy. He was just, you know, ready on one, take one, ready on two, take two. Okay, roll tape. It's like, whoa, this is so exciting.
It is
like
exciting.
A ballet. It is exciting. I love it. I probably would have gone into that direction if I hadn't gotten into music.
Really?
Yeah.
In front of the camera or behind the camera?
Behind it.
You'd love
behind the camera.
You like the technology, yeah.
Yeah.
Right before you dropped off, I was asking you, I can't remember, did you get into ham radio? Did you do any ham radio?
I didn't get a ham license. I got a single sideband CB, and I would used to talk to Australia and New Zealand from California. But
wow.
It was illegal.
Again, with the 25 watts.
No, it was only the less than 25. It was like the, 10 watts or 12 watts or something like five. I think they're 5 watts.
5 watts. Yeah. So, and now you introduced me to the Samsung microphone. I know you're using a pretty fancy microphone there. Tell me a little bit about the microphone technology of the 60s. Have we made advances or is it pretty much the same?
The best mics were around in the 60s. We used Telefunkens. They were made in Germany and later became Neumann. And they're still the best mics on the market. Frank Sinatra used to use one, and the Beatles used them, and we used them in the Birds. All the big studios had either Telefunken or Neumann mics, and they're, you know, just really warm, full body. They get probably from I know it's from 20 to 20 kilohertz, but they get nuances that you can't get even with those specs on other mics. So they're really great.
Were they ribbon or were they condenser or?
They were tube condenser.
Tube condenser, and you were telling me that. You have a tube condenser where you were going to use for this interview, but Skype makes it sound too muddy.
Right. This is a transistor condenser, and the tube condenser is a little too warm for this. It's a Stedman 1100B.
Oh, how fun.
And it's got a tube that's from a Russian fighter plane.
Because they're not making tubes anymore. That's what's interesting.
No, it's hard to find the tubes. Yeah.
Yeah. But there, so many were made that they're still around. I know we have an AM transmitter here,
And the you scavenge the tubes because nobody's making the tubes anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Do you now? What do you? Have you been following what Neil Young is doing with this Pono player? This desire to kind of get higher quality digital music.
I have, and I haven't had a chance to listen to it, but I think it's a good idea. I mean, obviously, MP3s are a compromise, and it's amazing. We have a whole generation of people who don't know what real audio sounds like. You know, they've never been to a recording studio and heard what it sounds like on a playback, and that's what Neil's trying to accomplish. I hope it works for him.
It was kind of a life-changing experience I had a few years ago. I went down to Lucasfilm here, and they have a symphonic sound stage. And it actually was—they were recording music for a video game, for Uncharted. But it was a—it was like a 108-piece orchestra, and they had kettle drums and stuff. And to go in that room while the orchestra is playing and to be surrounded by them—it is a very different experience. And there is a quality to it that you absolutely lose in a recording.
Yeah, you do. But with a really good system, you can capture quite a lot of that.
Absolutely. I'd go into the control room and they have big Rebel speakers and, you know, and it sounds wonderful. And then I've played the game since and it's not quite as rich and vibrant of a sound. So do you think that we have a generation growing up who just don't understand what music's supposed to sound like?
They haven't really been exposed to the real thing.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with guitars, with the guitar sound they get in the studio. A lot of guitars have little... Pickups built under here, and they sound real tinny, but people have grown accustomed to that sound, and they think that's the sound guitars are supposed to have. They don't know it's supposed to sound like big and full body. They don't get that from the thing. It sounds like to me, it sounds like rubber bands on a cereal box. You know, it's like
So you stayed with acoustic, you played electric, but you stayed with acoustic guitars primarily?
Yes, and I use a condenser mic on stage. I don't use a pickup on stage, even though it's more convenient to have a pickup and maybe a wireless, and you can walk around with it. But it's a compromise.
I know you were doing Folk Den. Are you still doing Folk Den, or are you?
Absolutely, yeah. I've done one every month since November of 1995.
Tell us about that.
Well, it started back when I was listening to a Smithsonian Folkways album in the 95. And it dawned on me that I wasn't hearing a lot of traditional songs on the radio or at folk clubs because all the new, quote, unquote, folk singers were singer-songwriters. They were like, you know, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell.
Right.
And I thought, what's going to happen when Odetta dies? Well, she just did a year or so ago.
Right.
Pete Seeger's 93. And so I thought, I can do my part. I knew how to record songs on a computer, which was kind of a new thing back 17 years ago. And put them up on the internet, which was also a new thing. And I started doing that in first wave form and then real audio and then MP3 format. And I've got over 200 free MP3s for people to download with the chords, the lyrics, and a little story about the song in hopes that they will download the songs and share them with their families and friends and learn them and keep them alive. That's the idea.
I just love that. I think you're probably doing more than the Smithsonian to keep folk music alive. It's so cool. And this was 1995. This was very early days of the internet.
The dawn of the internet. Yeah. Just when the civilians were allowed to use it.
And also, you know, they're Creative Commons licensed. As you say, you give them away. Right. That must have been... did you feel like this, because it's folk music, that was the right thing to do? Or?
Yeah. Well, I took the business model from two things. From the Grateful Dead...
Right.
Who let people come in and record their concerts, and it never hurt them. And from Microsoft, who gave away Internet Explorer.
Right.
And I thought, you know, this isn't going to hurt. This is going to be a good thing, and it's a good, cheap way to publish it around the world. So why not?
You know, a lot of credit goes to the Grateful Dead, who well before any of this was going on, were really open. And you see all the jam bands that have followed them having kind of the same tradition of giving it away. And I just think it's...
Yeah, well, the business model is you give some things away and you sell other things. That's what we do. So we have stuff for sale on the internet, but we give away the folk songs just to keep them alive. And I just love it. School systems around the world have picked it up and they use it in their curriculum, which is very gratifying.
I have many of the Folk Den CDs, and I love them. You have a new CD of sea shanties.
Yes.
Can we hear a sea shanty?
Okay.
What is this? First of all, what is a sea shanty?
Well, sea shanties are technically the work songs the sailors used on the old sailing ships in the 1840s and so on, the packet ships and the whaling ships. Mm-hmm. And they had different styles for different types of work. They had capstan shanties for pushing this wench around that was hand. Uh-oh, somebody's calling me. John Dvorak is calling.
Is it Dvorak, really?
Yeah, it's Dvorak.
Tell him to shut up and go away. I'm working. Pick it up, sure.
I'll pick it up?
Yeah. He's calling you on the phone? Answer, we'll just pause. That's fine.
Oh, he's on Skype. He's on Skype.
I wonder if we can conference him in.
I don't know how to do that. I'm not sure how to do that.
Pick him up, tell him we'll call him, and we'll conference him in.
He went away.
Would you give it a shot, John? See if you can call John and...
Tell him we're doing this.
Tell him Roger's busy, but if he wants to come on with Roger and me, that would be wonderful.
I'd love to talk to him, yeah.
Yeah.
I turned him on to a radio a couple of months ago, the Bofang, because he got into ham, and I found this great little ham radio that they're selling for like $50. I don't know if he told you about it. But.
No, not yet. He's probably embarrassed too, because I have a rather elaborate ham shack here that I never use.
Oh, okay. Well, the great thing about this radio, it not only works on 2 meters and 440, but it'll transmit on any frequency in the spectrum.
Wow. Wow, like, that's probably highly illegal.
460. Yeah. Like 460, you know, that frequency, and 453, and all those frequencies. It transmits and receives on all those frequencies, and it's programmable with no limitations. It's from China.
Wow. You could do your own numbers channel. You know about those numbers, mysterious numbers channel.
Yeah. Like 13,
right.
7, 4.
I think
two.
Mr. Dvorak is with us.
John C. Dvorak, we're trying to do an interview here with Roger McGuinn, and you're interrupting.
I'm sorry. You know, I see him so rarely on the Skype. I said, hey, we were doing some testing. So I decided to jump in and interrupt things.
Would you join? Cool. Would you join us for this conversation? This is the. You have a minute?
He was on episode one, after all.
Who are you talking to?
John.
Who are you talking with? Who are you interviewing?
Roger McGuinn. You ever hear of him?
No. Is he the guy that's. I think he's a guy. He did. Wasn't he with the Beatles?
Yeah,
that's right. The
he's
Beatles.
The fifth Beatle. John actually invented this show, Triangulation. We did the first show together. He named it, and then he disappeared into the ether.
Yeah, and then Leo pulled a Calacanis on me.
I did. I stole it. Robbed him blind. Are you setting up for No Agenda Show, John? I don't want to interrupt if you have a show.
No, we were actually. I mean, I hate to interrupt you. But and hi, Roger. I just wanted to say hi.
No, you're not interrupting.
Hi,
in fact, I'd love you to participate in this because I think
I don't
know...
have a camera on this system.
Don't worry. You can just talk. You'll be a disembodied voice.
Well, I've also got to go get some clips for tomorrow's show.
Oh, all right.
And as much as I'd love to chat up with you guys because, you know,
well,
and
you
Roger...
know, you introduced me to Roger, so I feel like...
Yeah, well, Roger's a... I'm trying to introduce him to Paul Allen.
Really?
How to tune it for this thing.
Boy, that thing is... You're off a little bit on one.
John, I was just telling Leo about the Bofang I told you about. The Bofang radios.
Yeah.
Did you buy one of those, John, so you could transmit your own numbers station?
Yeah, I have. In fact, he got me to get one, and then Adam Curry got one, and then Curry's gone off and gotten his license, and he's getting his general, and he's going for expert.
Ooh.
And so, like, we're going to be the whole... And he set up a repeater in Texas. He's gone nuts.
Wow, that's cool. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, if I guess.
But you can talk on police frequencies with these things.
Oh, any frequency, it sounds like.
I know. I was in Chicago, and they're transmitting all their police calls are on 460.
Ah.
Nice.
Ah. So, John, give us one, since you know Roger so well, give us a question, a request, just one input, and then we'll let you go.
Ask him how his back's doing.
How's your back doing?
My back's better. I don't know what happened, but for about eight or 9 years, I had a real bad sciatica problem, then it just kind of went away. So I guess the vertebrae fused together all by themselves or something. I didn't have any operations on it.
Clean living, Roger.
Oh,
yeah.
That's good.
So Roger has a new album out. We were just about to play a song from it. It's called CCD. It's a collection of sea shanties.
See, I put a capo on here and then it knocked it out of tune, so I got to retune it. So give me a second here, okay?
So when do you leave for the Super Bowl, Leo?
Tonight, midnight. And Roger, on Sunday, he's going to miss the Super Bowl because he is sailing to New Zealand from Los Angeles. and Roger, what a perfect time to sing sea shanties all the way down as you winch the anchor up and down.
Yeah, that's one of the lectures I do is the songs of the sea.
Oh, perfect.
And I've got a MacBook Air with video footage I put together in Final Cut Pro. I took like five movies. Like I took Master and Commander and
Love
Pirates of the Caribbean and a bunch of like a Moby Dick uh-huh. and got little clips out of all of them and put them together behind these sea shanties with the lyrics underneath so the audience can sing along if they want to.
Fun.
It's a lot of fun.
It's a kind of sea shanty karaoke.
Sea shanty karaoke.
That's it. You got it. Okay, I was explaining. Leo asked me the very pertinent question, what is a sea shanty? And I was saying that they're the work songs from the golden age of sail, from the tall ships back in the 1840s or so, where they had different styles of songs for different types of work. They had capstan shanties for pulling up the anchor. They'd push, they had these bars that they'd stick into a winch and walk around it and pull up the anchor. And that would be a capstan shanty. And then they had halyard shanties for hauling ropes and pulling the sails up in the yards to get the sails up. And then they had short haul shanties for smaller tasks. And then they had what they call forecastle songs. The forecastle is a forecastle or the front of the ship where the sailors lived. And that's where they would sing songs for their own entertainment about things they'd done or things they wished they'd done. You know, mostly conquests and
where did you get onto this? I mean, I can see it stemming from your folk singing, den, kind of collecting old classics. But where did you get to this fork? What caused the fork to go into the direction of the shanties? I mean, you must have run into something or somebody ran into you and they said, how come you aren't doing these?
Right. Well, I've always loved them. I was first introduced to them back in the 50s at a Pete Seeger concert. He explained all the different things I was just telling about how they worked on the ship and what they did. And so they've been part of the folk den ever since I started it. And, you know, that folk den project, I say it's got a bunch of them on there. And our thought was, well, let's separate. Oh, you've been always trying to get me to do a Christmas album. And so I started to do that, but I wasn't really happy with the way it was going. Then I tried to do a blues album from all those songs that were on there. And that wasn't working out too well. And then I was going to do a children's album. And we got a collection of those songs. And then I finally figured out, gee, what I really want to do is a sea shanty album. So I put that together, and that's what we got.
I love the idea. I don't know why, but there's just something about it's romantic, yet they're work songs. They probably have, for some of them, a rhythm because they're working to keep them working in rhythm together, right?
Exactly. They all have a rhythm, and they synchronize the work with that. I'm going to sing you one now. This is called, let's see. It's called Randy Dandio. Now you're ready to head for the horn. Way, hey, roll and go. Our boots and our oilskins are still in the pond. Come here, Alec and Randy Dandio. And it's heave a pull, heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor's aboard, the cable's all stored. Come here, Alec and Randy Dandio. Buster up the leaves, the wind's drawing free. Way, hey, roll and go. Let's get the rags up and we'll drive her to sea. Come here, Alec and Randy Dandio. And we're outward bound for the Ballypo Bay. Way, hey, roll and go. Get cracking, be lads, it's a mighty long way. Come here, Alec and Randy Dandio.
Love it.
If they could sing that well on the ship.
Well, they, you know, the sailors who did that, the shantymen, were just regular sailors, but a lot of them were pretty good singers, too. Like the British folk singer A.L. Lloyd was a real sailor back in the 1950s. And he did a lot of albums of sea shanties. I got a lot of the ones I know from him.
Would they play guitars, or would they use squeeze boxes, or would they have any musical accompaniment at all?
Squeeze boxes were very popular. Yeah. Sometimes they would have a mandolin or a guitar, but size was an issue because there wasn't a lot of storage space on the ship.
And humidity, I can't imagine it's too good for a stringed instrument.
No, it's not good for stringed instruments. They rust. But a lot of sea shanties are traditionally a cappella. And you get, I don't know if you've been exposed to the Fisherman's Friends. It's a group out of Cornwall, England, and they sing a cappella sea shanties. And it's an interesting group of people because they're all real fishermen, but they got discovered by the BBC and they got a million-pound record deal and they made this album and they started doing all these tour dates. And then the internal tension started because they didn't want to quit their day job. You know, they're fishing. they didn't want to go on the road and sing sea shanties.
How funny.
Interesting story.
All that money. Who wants that? I want to fish. I don't need the money. CCD is on, speaking of money, is on Amazon. It's a good deal, $8.99 for the electronic version of it, and that's 23 sea shanties. There's also a CD version. Why the name CCD?
Well, it's I was going to call it 23 Songs of the Sea, and I just thought a CCD would be more fun. Probably because I'm a gadget freak.
Now I get it. It's a pun.
That's funny.
John,
not
you want to
charge coupled device?
No.
Yeah, that's right.
John, do you want to stick around or you want to take off? I don't want to keep
I'm going to take off. I just want to say hi to both you guys and good luck getting down to New Orleans and the mess you're going to go into.
You know, apparently we're flying through Atlanta and there was just a tornado in Atlanta.
Well, that's good because it won't happen 2 days in a row.
Right.
You got it made.
They never strike twice.
And, turned over cars on I-75.
Yeah, it was terrible. It looked horrible. Yeah. And that's right where we're flying. I do hope it clears up. We don't leave till midnight tonight, so maybe by then it'll be gone.
A red eye. Okay. See you, guys.
See you, John. John C. Dvorak.
Okay, John.
ChannelDvorak.com, host of No Agenda Show, and a regular on the Twit Network. And that was very serendipitous, Roger. I'm really glad he called. Because he introduced me to you, and the first introduction... and it blew me away. He brought, and this was probably 20 years ago, brought me an album cover. This is back in the days of vinyl, of a Byrds album that you autographed.
Right.
And it was, and you mentioned Call for Help, the TV show. And I almost fell over in a dead faint. I still a treasured possession hanging on my wall at home. I love it.
Yeah, well, I loved Call for Help and Screensavers. I used to watch them all the time.
Oh, that's so neat.
And, it was great fun.
That's so
I still have some old videotapes of Screensavers.
So does, turns out, so does G4. And we're trying to get them to release. They have the original tapes
of
most of the shows. And while there's absolutely no value to them or us, we're trying to, you know, for promotional consideration or something, trade something. Because I want to get those tapes. We digitize them. I'd put them online just for nostalgia's sake. They're too old to be of any use to anybody anymore.
Right. Well, no, but they're fun. It's fun to see what the new technology of like the 80s and 90s was.
Yeah.
You know,
it's so history. Cool. Wasn't that long ago, Roger.
Well, it was the 90s.
90s and thousands.
90s and thousands.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Do you now, you mentioned Pete Seeger a few times and a huge hero of mine as well. He's 93. Do you stay in touch with him at all?
Yes, I do. Well, I haven't talked to him personally in a while, but I've been to his house and we recorded together and I played for his 90th birthday at Madison Square Garden. We had a huge bash for his 90th birthday. He's going to be 94 in May. He's going along, but he's still working.
Amazing. I actually had the pleasure of recording a song for him. He needed a recording for, it was a charity album. And he just came in with his guitar, and we sat him down, and I recorded it. And I'm no studio engineer, but, boy, you don't need much of a studio engineer when you have that incredible voice.
He's the nicest guy, too. He's just incredible.
So sweet.
I met him when I was 16. He didn't remember it, but I went to a concert in Chicago at the Navy Pier that, for some reason, got canceled. But Pete, being the kind of guy he is, wouldn't let anybody go away disappointed. So he did an impromptu concert on the loading dock of the Navy Pier. And I was one of the 20 kids out there. You know, I had my banjo with me. I was all excited to see it. And I got to talk to him, and it was great.
Holy cow. Do you, you know, it's interesting. There seems to be a little bit of a resurgence in folk music. I'm thinking of the Avett Brothers, Mumford & Sons. We're starting to see, and you're hearing banjo again. What is it because it's a truer, it seems like a truer kind of music than pop music? I don't know what it is.
I don't know. I wouldn't give it a value. I'd say that's probably what the best thing about it is. It's, are you getting me okay?
Because
say it again,
because whatever you said, we missed it. All we heard was because, and that's the value of it. And now okay. I'm dying to know.
I'll say folk music is really enduring because it's based on real stories of real people.
Yeah.
And they're tunes that have been around for generations, usually old English, Irish, Scottish, Welsh folk songs, just basic tunes, and the people put new words to them. But they got to the Appalachians and became what is now country music.
Right.
And there's a lot of value to it from just the human interest standpoint.
Yeah, of course, and historic and so forth. But I don't. Maybe it's just me, but it really does. It also resonates in a way that I just find it. It's living history. Osned says in our chat room. She's in Australia, but I think it is. It's living history in some ways, and so it's fun to hear that.
That's what attracts me to it. I love that.
You hear the voices of people from hundreds of years ago singing. Mm-hmm. They come alive again.
Yeah.
Other people, I notice you have a link to Bob Dylan's webpage on your Folk Den webpage. Have you stayed in touch with him?
Well, I see him every once in a while. He's kind of busy. He's on the road perpetually. There have been times when we've been on the road together in the same city, and he'll invite me up on stage to do, you know, a couple of songs like Tambourine Man or Knocking on Heaven's Door, which I recorded with him in the first place. I was on the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid soundtrack album with Bob, and I played my Rickenbacker on that.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was. I think there's a little credit somewhere, but it's not a big deal. Yeah,
one of my favorite songs, and I saw you perform that with him in 1975 during the Rolling Thunder review.
Yeah, that was a blast. That tour was the most fun tour. It lasted a couple of months. We had Joan Baez and Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and Joni Mitchell was out there, and
Mick Ronson on his amazing
soaring guitar. Yeah, T-Bone Burnett. Oh, yeah. It's incredible. It's an incredible band.
And the performance you did of 8 Miles High, your famous Bird song, I will never, never forget. That was that was one of the highlights of that concert for me.
Was Joan Baez dancing behind me that night?
Yeah. It was in New Haven, Connecticut in 1975. And I was probably dancing in front of you as she was dancing behind you.
It was amazing.
It is to this day, and I've seen many hundreds of concerts, the my most memorable concert.
Thanks. Thank you.
And there was this spirit of camaraderie on stage.
What Bob was doing, by 75, the music business had gone very, very commercial. You know, there's always kind of a balance between art and commerce in music. And the commerce had kind of taken over. So Bob was trying to put the art back into it. That's what that whole tour was about.
Vic G in our chat room says you do an acoustic version of 8 Miles High. Do you perform that still?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I did it at Macworld with you.
I remember.
2 years ago. Yeah, 2 years ago.
I probably requested it.
That was fun. Thank you for inviting me to that. That was really fun.
Was that at the Apple Store we did that? Or I can't remember where we did that.
No, it was at the Moscone Center, I think.
Oh, that's right. It was the talk that I gave there. That's right. Yeah.
Right. It was a conference or a,
right.
It's like a panel.
Yeah. Yep.
And you invited me to be on it. And I asked my wife, Camilla, and she said, well, I can fly you out there with freaking flyer points. And I said, nah, that's no fun. I want you to come too. And we just driven across country. We drive across country because I take four instruments. And as I told you, airplanes break my guitars.
Yep.
So she said, well, I don't want to drive back across the country. And about 10 minutes later, our agent who books us on cruise liners came back and said, the Queen Victoria wants you to do some lectures from New York to San Francisco.
Perfect.
Yeah.
It was meant to be.
It was. It was meant to be. So
I do remember that now. It was a beautiful performance. Yeah. We have video of that somewhere. We can find that.
Just checking my tuning. I'll do a little bit of it for you here.
Sure.
Well, I'm adding some things to it. This is another part I'm putting in it. Not working?
No,
not
working. And it's really a shame because it's just Skype is just unfortunately screwing it up. But boy, does that sound good. Oh, my gosh. And I love what you're doing with it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, I love that. One of my favorite songs anyway. When did you start writing songs? Was that at the very beginning or did that come later?
I worked for Bobby Darin back in 1962.
You were in the Brill Building, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
That's where I learned how to write songs.
That was the famous building downtown New York City where Carole King and so many of the great songwriters were working. Who was working there? Bobby Darin?
Yeah, Bobby Darin was there. Artie Young and Kenny Resnick were there. Artie Resnick and Kenny Young. Mm-hmm. And Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Burt Bacharach. It was quite a crew.
Unbelievable. You know, yeah. It sounds like a factory, but in fact, some of the best American popular music was written there.
Well, they were professionals. It takes practice to write good songs, and they practiced a lot. So,
did you learn? What did you learn? I mean, were you studying what they were doing? Were you interested in that?
Yeah. Well, I learned the basic formula of intro and verse and pre-chorus, chorus and verse and out, and to get a hook on the beginning and the end and that sort of thing. It's a formula, and if you do it right, it works every time.
Do you still follow that kind of a formula, or have you gone beyond that?
No, I've kind of, when I turned 50, I decided to reinvent myself as a folk singer. I thought, it's just more dignified to be a folk singer now. I think I'll just do that.
It was either that or standards. You could. There's two ways to go.
Oh, right. I could have done like, come fly with me, come fly, let's fly away.
No, I'm glad you went with folk, Roger. I really am. It does seem to be, though, that's the people find that, get to that fork in the road, and then they decide to do something.
Standards. I have seen people do that. You know, they'll go to old standards or do Spanish music or something else. Yeah.
Right. And again, it might just be my personal taste, maybe because I grew up listening to Pete Seeger and then the whole L.A. folk scene, like Joni Mitchell and James Taylor. But I just love it. There's something about it that really it seems honest.
It is honest. Yeah, it's real songs from real working people. And they always have a good message. Sometimes it's a little tragic. There are quite a few of them that focused on, like, hang down your head, Tom Dooley, poor boy, you're going to die kind of thing. But
well, I'm looking at the latest Folk Den posting. It's a story of John Hardy. You can't get more depressing than that.
No, he's on the gallows. That's a real picture of him from the newspaper.
So the story of John Hardy is a true, you never know with folk music. It's legendary or true. I mean, John Hardy, that's a true story, huh?
It is a true story, yeah.
Oh, that's so great. Where do you draw your inspiration from these days?
Well, mostly the old records, the old folk songs, some of the books. There's a great online resource called the Mudcat Cafe that has a digital folklore traditional database. And that's got thousands and thousands of traditional songs. So
that's Mudcat.org.
And then I've got the old books. I've got books, and I've got the Harry Smith anthology and all kinds of stuff.
And is performing still an important part of your day?
Yeah, we perform. My wife and I go out on the road together from I think April until around October, because we don't like to drive in the snow.
Right.
And we don't go above I-40 in the wintertime.
I love it.
And so this is a great time to do those cruise lectures, and that's a lot of fun.
Fun! I know. What a great idea! Thank goodness those exist. And then people who go on these cruises. We'll see, and I know they all do this kind of some sort of enrichment, but boy, to get to see and hear Roger McGuinn on a cruise, that's pretty.
It's fun for me, too. We love to be on the sea. But I do have a concert coming up at the Stagecoach. It's coming up pretty soon. Might want to. Could you Google that?
I will Google it for you. Roger McGuinn and Stagecoach.
I can't reach my keyboard.
The Google is amazing.
I love Google.
It knows all. What technologies are you interested in? Actually, Songkick here has a list of your upcoming tour dates. The Joe Hart Theater in Rochester, April 15th. The Pollock Theater in Monmouth University, April 19th. Empire Polo Field, Indio, California. Oh, that's at the Stagecoach Country Music Festival.
That's the one I was talking about.
I want to go to that. I might come down to Indio and see that. And then you'll be in Glen Allen, Virginia on the June 15th. But that festival is April 26th through 28th.
Right. And there are quite a few tour dates that haven't made it up to the web yet. But they start rolling in about this time of year. And then they get on Polestar and other sites.
Yeah.
But sometimes we do like 50 a year, sometimes 25. Last year was a little slower. But sometimes we go to Europe and we'll do 25 over there and then 25 or 30 over here. And we take trains when we're in Europe. We love that. We take the Queen Mary 2 over to Europe and we take trains all over Europe. We just love the train system there.
You also play with my friend Kathy Kamen Goldmark's Rock Bottom Remainders sometimes, I know.
Oh, I know. We miss her. Oh. That was so wonderful. And she put that band together. It was together, 20 years or so? I got to do it with them for about 12 years, and that was such a kick. And we really
missed Dave Barry, Roger McGuinn, Stephen King.
Amy Tan.
Amy Tan. And, so the story is that Kathy, and I knew her because she was she would bring authors around in San Francisco. And when I was a radio host in San Francisco in the 90s, I met, you know, she'd bring the best authors, wonderful people to me. It was kind of a public relations job, but she also escorted him around and drove him around. And she's such a sweet, wonderful person. And and so as she got to know these famous authors, it turns out almost all of them had harbored secret ambitions to be musicians.
Right.
Were they any good, really, Roger?
Well, honestly, some of them were pretty good, yeah. Ridley and Dave could play good guitar and bass, and they had a real drummer who worked for Bruce Willis when he wasn't playing with the Remainders, and they had a real saxophone player. And then Greg Iles was a real guitar player in a band before he became a writer.
And I hear this Roger McGuinn that used to play with them sometimes. He was pretty good, too.
Yeah, well, you know, they let me play with him. It was a lot of fun. James McBride, the author, played saxophone with him. He's excellent as well.
Hysterical. And I see the most recent one you did, Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. What does he play?
He doesn't.
He just stands there.
Yeah, he's a remainderette. Puts on a wig and sings along.
You know what's great about it, though, is these are all really great people. And so you can see that it's fun for them to all get together and kind of live their dream.
Right. It was always for a good cause. And But Kathy passed away last year, and so they decided to hang it up. But
yeah.
I wonder if they're going to really hold to that. I think they might bring it back.
It would be nice. It would be a great thing in her memory. She, it was kind of sudden and surprising. And she,
it was, yeah.
It was very sad. We miss her quite a bit. And the Rock Bottom Remainders are reminders of her greatness. Roger's new CD, CCD, is available on Amazon or CD Baby or wherever you find great CDs. I'm sure it's on iTunes as well. It's CCD. If you like sea shanties, I'm so mad at Skype, but I guess really Skype was never designed to have complex, beautiful 8 Mile High music played down the pipe, so I'm not surprised. Maybe the next time you come out here, we can have a little concert.
That'd be good. We'll do it for real.
I would love that, Roger. It is such an honor and a pleasure to know you and to get to talk to you from time to time, and I'm very grateful.
Well, it's mutual. Thanks a lot, Leo. I've always enjoyed watching you on TV, and it's great to get to know you, too.
Thank you. McGuinn, mcguinn.com. The Folk Den is at, where is the Folk Den? Well, it's a long link. Just go to, you can Google Folk Den.
You can just type in folkden.com.
Oh, it does work. Okay. Yeah. And there's great stuff on here. There's 4 CDs, but there's also, you can download the tracks from the website. And, I think a school could really use this as part of their music curriculum, should be using this, because the stories, the lyrics, and the music are here. And it really, I mean, you know, you've heard Oh My Darling, but do you know the story? Do you? And can you hear Roger McGuinn singing it? This is fantastic, really fantastic. I hope maybe someday you do that Christmas CD.
It's in the hard drive. You know, I've got all those things kind of ready to go, but they need sprucing up.
Yeah.
And Dvorak has always been getting after me to do a Rickenbacker instrumental Christmas CD. He thinks that could be a big one.
Oh, Oh, it would be a big, it would be, I would play it nonstop the entire month of December.
Well, it's a possibility.
Great. My regards to Camilla. Thank you so much, Roger.
Okay, thank you, Leo.
Have a wonderful voyage to New Zealand.
Thank you. Have a great Super Bowl.
Rub the nose of a Maori when you're there.
Okay.
Take care, Roger. Thank you.
Have some lamb and eggs for you.
Yeah, there you go. We have that here, too, you know. This is not just New Zealand. We have lamb and we have eggs. We're famous for it in Petaluma. You come here, and I'll make sure it's waiting for you.
Okay, great, because they have that every day in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, they got a lot of lamb. Yeah. And I imagine a few eggs. We're going to try Skype one more time. Just something for us. See if we can get Skype to behave. Fantastic. We got 90% of it. That is just great. So I'm gonna figure this out because I'm going to get you here and I'm going to have Steve Martin with his banjo here and we're going to have a hell of a hoedown.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we got to play with Steve with the Rock Bottom Remainders one time.
Yeah.
And yeah, we did some stuff.
He's an amazing. This guy has a lot of talent. He's an amazing banjo player.
Yeah, I heard his new banjo album. It was, I guess, out last year. It's really great.
He's just, we're going to get him on in April. He's just recorded a new CD with Edie Brickell, and he'd play the banjo into the iPhone and send her the recording, and then she'd write a song and sing it into GarageBand and send it back to him, and they made an album that way.
Yeah, wow. Well, you know, I've got a 4-track on my iPhone. Oh, I wanted to tell you a little iPhone story.
Sure.
Last year, I bought this iPhone on Amazon for cash, you know, like $400 or something. And I never put a SIM card in it, but instead I just used it with a Verizon Wi-Fi card on 4G. And I used an app called Talkatone to make phone calls over Google. Mm-hmm. And so I completely bypassed the telephone companies. And I thought you'd like to hear that because I heard you talking about, hey, you know, maybe these cell phone companies are not going to, you know, work out. And
well,
maybe
I'm thinking that the iPad, you could do this with an iPad mini as well. And yeah, I would like to turn that. I don't want to carry a phone. I'll just carry the iPad mini.
Right.
Now, what you said, you have a 4-track recorder. What app are you using for that?
It's a free app called Gig Baby. And it's got
free.
A metronome. Gig Baby, GIGBABY.
Holy cow.
Gig Baby free, I guess it is now. I think you had to pay for it originally.
But it has a drum machine built into it, a metronome?
Yeah, it's got everything. It's a 4-track recorder. It's really cool.
Holy cow.
It's excellent quality. You know, it's like CD quality.
It's 99 cents.
Okay. All right.
That's good. That's close enough to free.
Yeah, well, it was free when I got it. So
that is amazing.
It was a free version of it.
And when you record, we mentioned this, the Neil Young stuff, but do you record at 44/1/16?
I record at 48 at 24.
24-bit, 48 kilohertz.
48 kilohertz, 48 kilohertz, 24-bit, yeah.
I think Pono is like 96, 48.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good. You know, you can do that, but that's like for DVDs and so on.
Right, and you may not
really hear
that.
A big difference between 48 and 96.
Right. So that's good to know. So if you're recording at home, kids, do what Uncle Roger does, 48 bits.
And 48 kilohertz, 24 bits.
24 bits. That's enough. Thank you, Roger. Yeah. What a thrill.
Okay, Leo.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, you too.
Roger McGuinn. We do triangulation. Isn't that great? I don't want to ever stop. We do triangulation every Wednesday around about 4 p.m., between 3 and 4 p.m. Pacific, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern time. You can tune in if you're around the world. 3 p.m., would be about midnight UTC. So you figure that out from your time zone. It's great if you watch live. We watch the chat room. We interact with the chat room. But, of course, all of these shows are made available after the fact in audio and video. You just download them from your favorite podcast application, iTunes, whatever, or twit.tv/TRI. And now the ritual. Karsten, who's next week? Jerry Pournelle, science fiction author and amazing raconteur will join us on Triangulation next week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.